here on VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Gregory Stockel, and Jill Robbins. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
Some large American companies, including Google, Facebook, and Twitter, are experimenting with cutting pay for employees working from home in less costly areas. The experiment at the technology companies could set a direction for other large American employers after the pandemic. A Google pay calculator, seen by Reuters, shows that Google employees could see changes in their pay if they go from working in the office to working from home permanently. Those who move farther away from the office could be hit harder. Facebook and Twitter have also cut pay for work-from-home or remote employees who move to less costly areas. Google offers employees a pay calculator, a device or program that permits them to see the effects of a move. But some remote employees, especially those who commute from long distances, could experience pay cuts without changing their address. A Google spokesperson told Reuters that pay will differ from city to city and state to state, adding that Google always pays at the top of the local market based on where an employee works from. One Google employee, who asked not to be identified for fear of punishment, travels to the Seattle office from a nearby area. The employee was considering remote work, but decided to keep going to the office, despite the 2-hour trip. The employee would likely see their pay cut by about 10% by working from home full-time. That is the estimate based on Google's work location tool. It's as high of a pay cut as I got for my most recent promotion. I didn't do all that hard work to get promoted to then take a pay cut, they said. Promote means to change the position of someone to a higher or more important one. Jake Rosenfeld of Washington University in St. Louis researches pay structures. Rosenfeld said Google's pay structure worries employees about the effects on their families. What's clear is that Google doesn't have to do this, Rosenfeld said. It's not like they can't afford to pay their workers who choose to work remotely the same that they are used to receiving. Images of Google's pay calculator, seen by Reuters, show that an employee living in Stamford, Connecticut, an hour from New York City by train, would be paid 15% less if he or she worked from home. A worker from the same office living in New York City would see no cut from working from home. Images showed 5% and 10% differences in the Seattle, Boston, and San Francisco areas. Discussions with Google employees suggest pay cuts as high as 25% for remote work if they left San Francisco for another area of California, such as Lake Tahoe. A Google spokesperson told Reuters that the company will not change an employee's pay based on them going from office work to being fully remote in the city where the office is located. For example, employees working in the New York City office will be paid the same as those working remotely from another New York City location. I'm John Russell.
The coastal town of Mendocino in California is experiencing a severe drought. Thousands of people were coming to visit the town when coronavirus restrictions eased. But the visitors are seeing signs asking them to save water. About 1,000 people live in Mendocino, which is 240 kilometers north of San Francisco. The town is known for its houses from the 1800s and its fog. But 2 years of very little rain has emptied wells that the local people depend on. Mendocino's water problems grew after the city of Fort Bragg, a few kilometers to the north, informed officials that it also had very little water. That is because the nearby Noyo River reached its lowest level in many years. Ryan Rhodes is head of the Mendocino City Community Services District. His office helps supervise the town's underground water supply. He said, "This is a real emergency." Eric Hillsland and his wife normally would not need to buy extra water until July or August to supply their hotel, the Alegria Oceanfront Inn. But the property's well added little water earlier this year, and by February, the Hillslands were ordering 13,250 liters a week. Hillsland said he is asking guests to keep the water shortage in mind. He and his wife also are finding ways to save water, such as using bed coverings made of a special cloth that needs less water to wash. Mendocino depends on groundwater in a system of about 400 privately owned wells. Many of them were dug by hand when the town was established in the 1850s. The town's economy depends on the 2,000 tourists who come each day between May and October each year, Rhodes said. Businesses have traditionally brought in extra water in the fall. But after a second dry winter, many have had to order more, much earlier than before. With more tourists this year, locals have had to find drinking water from places that are farther away. This has increased the price. In February, Hillsland said he was paying $300 to bring in 13,250 liters of water. Now it costs $600. Some restaurants are cutting back their hours to reduce costs. Hillsland said if the lack of water gets worse, he will have to start closing rooms. If that happens, the two will have a situation like they had at the beginning of the pandemic. No money coming in, but bills to pay. People in the town are considering ways to deal with the problem. They include bringing in water by boat, airplane, or train. They also could add community tanks that can hold up to 1.9 million liters of water. People in the town are considering asking the federal government to set up a center to turn salt water into fresh water, and even a system to turn fog into water. Rhodes said all of these ideas would be costly, and the town would need the support of the state and federal governments. I'm Gregory Stockel.
Your English teacher may have told you, do not split infinitives. But if you have been reading Everyday Grammar for the past few years, you already know that we no longer worry so much about this rule. As a student of grammar, you likely know that an infinitive usually begins with the word to and is followed by a verb in its base form. We can see examples of infinitives in many news stories about the Delta variant of COVID-19, such as to spread in the sentence. The Delta variant is able to spread faster than the original virus. A split infinitive happens when an adverb or other modifier is placed between to and the verb. For example, we could add the adverb rapidly to this sentence. Because of vaccine hesitancy, Dr. Anthony Fauci expected COVID-19 rates to rapidly increase. In this case, the sentence would also be correct in this form. Because of vaccine hesitancy, Dr. Anthony Fauci expected COVID-19 rates to increase rapidly. But there are other cases where you cannot change the word order. Staying with the health crisis, we read that coronavirus cases due to the Delta variant are predicted to more than double in some states. Here, the verb to double means to increase by 100%. So it would be incorrect to change this sentence to coronavirus cases due to the Delta variant are predicted to double more than in some states. The same thing is true of the modifiers up to and over. For example, we can make this sentence, the CDC says the Delta variant has the ability to up to triple infection rates in coming weeks. But as with more than, the sentence would not be correct if you put up to after the infinitive or moved it before the to of the infinitive. The CDC says the Delta variant has the ability to triple up to infection rates in coming weeks. The reason for these split infinitives has to do with the nature of the modifiers more than, up to, and over. The Cambridge Grammar of the English Language calls these prepositional modifiers. Like prepositions in general, they must appear immediately next to the expression they combine with. If you have trouble remembering what a split infinitive is, you can think of a famous one in popular culture. The television show Star Trek always begins by describing its mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no one has gone before. Here, the adverb boldly appeared within the infinitive to go. As the Olympics ended this week, we heard about the medal count for each country. The United States brought home 39 gold medals, while the People's Republic of China earned 38. How would you use the verb to match to describe this situation? The answer is, the People's Republic of China was able to nearly match the U.S. for gold medals in the Olympics. And that's Everyday Grammar. I'm Jill Robbins.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we continue our story of the United States Constitution. In recent weeks, we discussed how the Constitution was written. In the summer of 1787, a group of delegates gathered for a convention in Philadelphia. Their plan was to rewrite the Articles of Confederation. Those articles created a weak union of the 13 states. Instead of rewriting the articles, however, they spent that summer writing a completely new plan of government. On September 17th, after 4 months of often bitter debate, the delegates finally agreed to the new plan. Now they had to get at least 9 of the 13 states to approve it. Delegates to the Philadelphia Convention had met in secret. They wanted to be able to debate proposals and change their minds without worrying about public reaction. Now they were free to speak openly. Each had a copy of the new Constitution. Newspapers also had copies. They published every word. Public reaction was great indeed. Arguments for and against were the same as those voiced by delegates to the convention. The Constitution would save the United States. The Constitution would create a dictator. Yale Law School professor Akhil Reed Amar says the public debate about the Constitution was one of its first successes as a democratic document. He notes that even democracies of long ago, like those in Greece or Italy, did not let citizens vote on their constitutions.
People could be for the Constitution or against it. No one was shut down. No one was put in prison if they liked George Washington or they didn't like George Washington. Just this proliferation, robust, wide open, uninhibited discourse up and down a continent.
Supporters of the new Constitution understood that to win ratification, they needed to speak out. So a few weeks after the document was signed, they began writing statements in support of the proposed Constitution. Their statements appeared first in newspapers in New York. They were called the Federalist Papers. They were published under the name of Publius, but they were really written by three men, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas says he deeply respects the men who wrote the Federalist Papers.
These are people who were engaged, who knew the Constitution. Also want you to know, these were not scholars. These were farmers. These were business people. Some of them who had formal education, some who did not. But they cared about this country.
Years later, historians said the Federalist Papers were the greatest explanation of the Constitution ever written. But in 1787, they had little effect on public opinion. The debate over the Constitution divided Americans into two groups. Those who supported it were known as Federalists. Those who opposed it were known as Anti-Federalists. The Anti-Federalists were not anti-American. They were governors, heroes of the Revolutionary War, and even a future president. Yet they distrusted the idea of a strong central government. Give too much power to the president, Congress, and the courts, they said, and citizens would no longer be free. They would lose the liberties gained in the war for independence from Britain. Law professor Akhil Reed Amar says the Anti-Federalists were an important part of the debate and of history.
The people who oppose the Constitution, who think it could be better still, they're not cast out. They become presidents of the United States, vice presidents of the United States, justices on the Supreme Court. It's extraordinary how they're kept in the process.
There were both Federalists and Anti-Federalists in the Continental Congress. The Congress had few powers, but it was the only central government the 13 states had at that time. It met in New York City. The convention in Philadelphia had sent the Continental Congress a copy of the new Constitution. Within 8 days, the Congress agreed that each state should organize a convention to discuss ratification. One by one, the states held those meetings. Delaware was the first state to ratify early in December 1787. All the delegates voted to approve it. Pennsylvania was the next to ratify, also in December. New Jersey ratified the Constitution in December, followed by Georgia and Connecticut in January. That made 5 states. The Federalists needed just 4 more to win ratification. Massachusetts voted in early February. Delegates to the state convention wanted the Constitution amended to include guarantees to protect citizens' rights. They agreed to ratify if these guarantees were added later. Maryland ratified the Constitution at the end of April. There, a number of delegates included a letter of protest with their vote. They said, if the plan of government were not amended, the liberty and happiness of the people would be threatened. At the end of May, South Carolina became the 8th state to ratify. Just 1 more state, and the new Constitution would become the law of the land. All eyes turned to Virginia. Virginia was the biggest of the 13 states. 1/5 of all the people in America lived in Virginia. The men who attended the ratifying convention were among the most famous names in the nation: James Madison, Patrick Henry, George Mason, James Monroe, Edmund Randolph, and John Marshall. The most famous Virginian, George Washington, stayed at his home, Mount Vernon. All during the month of June, however, riders brought him messages from the convention and carried messages back. Thomas Jefferson was still in Paris, serving as America's representative to France. But others kept him informed of everything that happened at home. Jefferson wrote back that he liked most of the Constitution, but he said, I do not like the fact that it does not contain a declaration of the rights of citizens. For 3 weeks, the Virginia delegates argued about the Constitution. By the end of June, they were ready to vote. Patrick Henry, the outspoken anti-federalist, asked to make a final statement. "If this convention approves the Constitution," Henry said, "I will feel that I fought for good reasons and lost the fight. If this happens, I will wait and hope. I will hope that the spirit of the American Revolution is not lost. I will hope that this new plan of government is changed to protect the safety, the liberty, and the happiness of the American people." Then the convention voted. Virginia approved the Constitution. However, like Massachusetts, it added that the document must include a Declaration of Rights for the nation's people. Federalists in Virginia thought their state was the ninth to ratify, the one that made the Constitution the law of the land. But they soon learned that New Hampshire had ratified a few days earlier. Virginia was number 10. That left three states, North Carolina, Rhode Island, and New York. In a way, New York was the most important of all. If New York refused to join the Union under the Constitution, it would be almost impossible for a central government to rule the nation. The 12 other states would be divided in two, geographically separated by New York State. Alexander Hamilton was a leader of the Federalists. They used their right to filibuster to make many long speeches to delay the vote. They wanted to wait to hear what Virginia would do. Early in July, they got the news. But New York's anti-federalists kept up the fight for three more weeks. It was not until the end of July that New York finally ratified the Constitution. The vote was extremely close, 30-27. Like Massachusetts and Virginia, New York demanded a Declaration of Rights. The long struggle to give the United States a strong central government was over. It took 4 months to write a new constitution. It took 10 months to ratify it. Yale Law School professor Akhil Reed Amar says adopting the Constitution was, in his words, the most democratic deed in history.
For the first time ever in the history of the planet, an entire continent got to vote on how they and their posterity would be governed. And there were lots of exclusions, you know, from our perspective, but we wouldn't exist, you know, as a democratic country, as a democratic world, but for that.
The Continental Congress declared that the Constitution would become effective the first Wednesday in March, 1789. The last two states, North Carolina and Rhode Island, did not approve it until many months after that date. Benjamin Rush of Pennsylvania, who had signed the Declaration of Independence, wrote down 8 words when he heard that the Constitution had been ratified. "It is done," he said. "We have become a nation." But before that, the nation's founders had one more question to answer. How would the Constitution guarantee citizens' rights? Delegates at the convention had raised the point many times, and several states made protecting citizens' rights a condition for approving the document.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.